Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. First, I am going to climb on my soapbox. I'm reading this from the Journal of the American Medical Association, July 9th of this year. And this is a opinion piece written by a medical assist, MA, Masters of Something, in something, Rita Rubin. And let's see, do they tell me anything about the author? No. So I don't know how she got in here, but go you, Rita. Nearly a century has passed since the AMA endorsed periodic medical examinations for apparently healthy persons. And so we're having a debate about that and in our society right now. Is it worth having people come in for primary care visits, for an annual examination when, you know, so many things can be done online and so many things can be done by phone surveys? And do we really need to bring people to the office and touch them? Well, of course, this being scientific medicine, we have the randomized clinical trials. And randomized trials comparing participants who receive periodic health checks or no health checks have found that periodic health checks did not reduce morbidity or mortality overall from cardiovascular disease or cancer. And based on these studies, the Society of General Internal Medicine has concluded, quote, the evidence base is definitely insufficient to support routine use of annual general health checks for asymptomatic adults without a specific concern, chronic condition, or evidence-based prevention strategy. All right, so I'm just going to kind of take a moment and step back from that and mention those endpoints there. Cardiovascular mortality from cardiovascular disease or cancer. And I want to talk about the purpose that the periodic health visit always served for me. And I'm speaking from the perspective of someone who started practicing primary care medicine in 1987, my residency, and became a full-time private practice doc in 1991. So, you know, I've gone through a few iterations of who's paying for it, who's calling the shots, and what are they asking for. And starting out with where the people who were paying for it and calling the shots were, for the most part, actually the patients, or they're stuck with that. Now, where the patients are pretty much completely disenfranchised, and the doctors as well, and the people calling the shots are people with management degrees. For the greater bulk of physicians are now employed, and the greater bulk of people who have insurance have really very little say beyond their choice of doctor, and good luck with that. The annual health visit is an extremely valuable thing because it's the only time I ever had, it's the only moment I ever had time to develop rapport and trust with a patient. And I still go and see my patients in the hospital always. And part of the reason I do that is because we have lots of data looking at stress and health outcome and pain control use and wound healing duration time and all have. And I have heard firsthand from way too many people that when their doctor walks in to the exam room in the emergency room to evaluate them for admission, or when their doctor walks in to their hospital room and says, how are you doing, that they experience an alleviation of stress because they are now, let's listen, they have someone who can speak for them and someone who has actually some knowledge to navigate the system. And that's how most of us primary care doctors saw ourselves back in the 90s, as navigators of an increasingly complex healthcare system in terms of both insurance and also practice. let's listen to Alan Gorrell, the professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and a primary care general internist. He says the answer to this conundrum has to do with the things the trials aren't looking at. And here's my critique of the evidence, says Dr. Gorrell. It strictly looks at the measurable, and they forget about all the other things that people get out of an annual visit. And I want to just take a spin on that, because a couple of weeks ago I went down for something sponsored by the CMA, and as California Medical Association, I'm going to be president of the local county society next year, and I'm president-elect this year, so they're trying to train me up. And it was a goals orientation, how to achieve goals talk, but it was taught by middle managers. And one of the things that people with MBAs and managers and middle management, and even I don't think the CEOs, they're obviously all over the map, but managers are taught to think in measurable outcomes. So you don't even try for an outcome you can't measure. Quarterly reports speak, right? 10% increase in user engagement scores on a test form that maybe 15% of people bother to return would be considered a win. But that doesn't mean that people develop any kind of benefit, any kind of emotional human relationship with their doctor. And I consider that to be highly valuable. A sustained and trusting healing relationship is going to lead to better compliance. People are going to take their medications. They're going to be willing to trust me with the fact that their spouse is abusive or that they can't afford their medication. They're not going to find it as easy to lie. And there's also that fact that they don't want to disappoint their doctor. So that's one of the reasons they do lie. But if you ask the question the right way, they'll actually tell you that they're not taking their pills and why. And then you can problem solve on that. The problem with our society, says Dr. Gorrell, and I underline this, is that relationships have become scarcer and undervalued. And I just want to emphasize that. We have now got books, people going on talk shows talking about how isolated and alienated people are, how they work from home and they don't have any kind of regular contact with other human beings except maybe the barista at the coffee shop, and how people are more depressed and more lonely than they've ever been. Doctors are more frustrated. They've become data clerks, to quote Eric Topel, who's a medical futurist, and I'm going to have to buy his book because I heard an interview that made me think I might actually want to listen to him for once. I've always thought he was very go-go pro-technology, but even he is talking about the loss of humanity in the patient-doctor relationship and how that's been a mistake. This is not something that's cut and paste. Any healthcare provider is just like another. No, the person that you have seen over the years, that you have a sense of as a human being, that you've developed some trust for, and who sees you as a human being and not, oh my God, just another sick patient with diabetes, that's huge. That is valuable. And we can't score it. We can't measure it. That doesn't mean it's not valuable. It's this classic science conundrum that I always talk about when reference to acupuncture. If there's no chiometer, then chi must not exist because I can't measure it, so I can't do science on it, so it's not real. Wrong. It's not measurable. It doesn't mean it's not real. Now let's listen to an alternative view. This is Lasse Krogsbull, a co-author of the recent Cochrane Review, saying, medical exam, medical schmam. He's a general surgeon, which I think may be relevant. It's possible that a checkup leads to a better physician-patient relationship, he said, but it might just be expensive and a waste of time if there are no problems. Again, the surgeon's view. His patients are anesthetized, and more than likely a physician assistant does his follow-up visits after the surgery. So what does he know about human relationships? Just asking. So the pressure on primary care physicians has been to make that primary care, that health check just shorter and shorter. And when I started my concierge practice 5 years ago, it was actually the first time I'd ever gone and read the Medicare regulations and the Medicare definition of what constitutes a health checkup for a patient over 65. And I'd been doing these, by the way, for 20 years. I didn't really understand what Medicare thought I was doing. I thought I knew. So when I actually read it, you could have knocked me out of my chair with a feather. The regulations for a Medicare annual exam do not require that the doctor actually even once touch the patient. You're supposed to get vital signs. That's usually done by a medical assistant. After that, well, guess what? You're supposed to find out if they're independent in their activities of daily living, if they can do their own grocery shopping and cooking. You're supposed to make sure, check the box, that they have an advance directive. And you're supposed, if they have certain diseases, you're supposed to bring them back for a disease visit to check the things like the hemoglobin A1C or look at their cholesterol, because that's not part of Medicare's definition of an annual healthcare screen. And if that's a health check, then I agree with the naysayers that there is no benefit to be derived. But the point of the checkup is not that. The point of the checkup is to develop and maintain a good long-term plan for health, to sit down and say, what are your priorities? To help match the patient's priorities and needs with the desirous medical outcomes, and also with the changes in behavior that meet, like quitting smoking or exercising, that we're trying to get people to do. Just a check the boxes form and a hi, how are you? I'm out of here. See you next year. That's useless. A half an hour, if I were in Kaiser or one of the other multi-specialty groups, a half an hour a year with the patient without having to look at my computer or do anything except talk to the person, a funded half an hour where I could learn about their concerns, about their values, where we could talk about their health challenges, and we could actually be human with each other in a room. I don't know how you could measure the health benefits, maybe health or their compliance with certain testing. Maybe somebody could do that study with all this wonderful big data number crunching stuff that we've got. At menarche in the tropics, girls' menstruation started at 11 or 10. In dark wintry countries, 15 or 16. Ergo, more primitive, more animalistic. However, Russia disproved this completely, accidentally, because no feminist they, because they electrified that huge country with a series of five-year plans. Drew a line from north to south, then first section to the west, first section to the east, and so on out. So she thinks there were about four steps, and surprise, as the lights went on and there was electricity at night, girls started to menstruate earlier across Russia in both directions, five-year block by five-year block. Not primitive at all, just less dark and more light. Thank you. And also, I would comment, Alouette, they also had good record keeping and shared information about important physiological variables, something that we are not doing here because there is a big fat act of Congress standing in our way. Thank you again for your wonderful and continuing information and entertainment. Our next email comes from Shelley in Ohio. Shelley, breast biopsy and marker placement is her subject. Hi, Dr. Dawn. Thank you so much for your extremely informative podcast. It is absolutely my favorite, and I've learned so much from you. I recently had a core needle breast biopsy done. During the procedure, the radiologist asked if it was okay to place a marker in the area where he did the biopsy. I was not expecting the question and agreed, but immediately after the procedure was done, I started questioning my decision. I don't really like the thought of a foreign object in my breast. I'm the kind of person who rarely takes medication. I try to live as clean as possible, and now I'm worried that the marker may cause problems, not just in my breast, but system-wide. What are your thoughts on this, and should I be concerned? If you do believe it is a problem, how difficult would it be to have it removed? And would a surgeon agree to remove it just because I'm uncomfortable knowing it is there? Thanks so very much. Well, that's certainly a lot to unpack, Shelley, so let's get started. First of all, the reason that you had your breast biopsy was undoubtedly because you had some abnormalities in your breast that required a biopsy. This is not something we do as part of routine annual work. And according to the literature that I was able to find on Google, on a quick Google Scholar search about this, the convention is that if the finding looks abnormal and there's a greater than 1 out of 25 chance on the mammogram, then that it might be cancer, then they do an image-guided breast biopsy. And of the women who have this biopsy, about 25% recommended for biopsy will be diagnosed with cancer, and the others will be diagnosed as benign. But remember the old magician's trick on stage magic where you put the woman, it's always a woman, in the basket and then you run the swords through the basket and it looks like you would have to have skewered the women. Well, that's more of a prostate biopsy, but if you can imagine just one sword going through the breast, you're trying to hit that place on the ultrasound. And if you come within and you put the marker down where you ended up, and then you come out and the marker tells you, did I get into that area of calcification? So there's weird little calcium spots. You want to biopsy those. You want one of them to be gone, and you'd like a marker saying, yep, that's you hit the spot. And then you know what to watch carefully in the future. Typically, the marker is a little tiny bit of titanium or stainless steel, and usually you can't feel it. Sometimes if it's very close under the skin, the biopsy marker will be a gel tube surrounding, and the person will feel that gel tube. It takes about 15 months, about a year and a half to dissolve. And in terms of allergic reaction, we have no idea, honestly, of the probability of that, because nobody's been looking for it. And when you do look for it as a clinician, you go to the medical literature. And in the medical literature, I found one article where they were looking at failed joint replacements. So they were in there anyway. And they took some biopsies and they found a lot of titanium and they found a lot of immune cells. But that's a failed joint replacement. So there's going to be inflammation. So it's difficult to know what to do with that data. There are cases with titanium metal implants of people having allergic reactions in their mouths or having hives on their face after an implant. It's a single case. There are not very many of them. Hard to know what to do with that. And so the research to prove a negative, which I will add is extremely difficult to do in the first place, hasn't been done. If you have a lot of titanium in your body, it might be a problem. So what I would suggest you do, for starters, is simply go ask them whether it was stainless steel or titanium. So at least you know what metal that they're dealing with. And it's whatever they have on the shelf. So find out what they have on the shelf so you know what to test for should you start getting any kind of recurrent skin rashes, particularly on the breast, or any other kind of reaction that's localized. You know, I'd probably get an antibody test against metal to see whether or not you've developed antibodies against that metal, or maybe you had them from before because you have a titanium tooth implant, but it doesn't sound like it given your description of your attitude about interventional things. So if you need to remove the implant or this little seed or marker, it can easily be done surgically. So that's not a problem. If you got creeped out, and I'm sure you could find someone, although I doubt you could get your insurance to pay for it, you could probably find someone who would take it out for you. And I have no idea what it would cost you. But I want to emphasize that this is creepy. I see that you're creeped out, but I don't really think it's a thing. I don't think it's something to worry about. I think the thing to worry about and be relieved about is that you don't have breast cancer and the biopsy was negative. And be happy that they can watch that area carefully and maybe have to go back in and find something if they missed it, sword through the basket thing. But assuming they didn't, congratulations. And I would just go out there and live a happy life and eat well and exercise and don't overdrink and do all of the things that you know about that are going to reduce your risk of breast cancer. And since you had some abnormalities, if you don't have a thyroid disease, probably be a good idea to take a couple of milligrams of iodine a day. There is a medical literature around low iodine, relative iodine deficiency, an increased risk of breast cancer. And when your breasts are saturated with iodine, they are less active. There's less fibrocystic disease. There's less metabolic activity. And so the breast kind of settles down. So I think iodine is a great thing to be taking as a preventative. And anyone I tell anyone who's got a family history, if I remember, and I'm probably not 100% on remembering, you know, take some extra iodine. I don't tell if they have thyroid disease. I don't tell them that because their endocrinologist will freak out, and I don't want to get into a urination contest with the endocrinologists ever because I'm going to lose. That's just how it goes. Let's do a science, deep science talk. This is about a new framework for studying congenital heart disease. And this came out of the journal Nature. They are studying what makes a heart. They were looking at the full spectrum of cells that come together to make a heart at the earliest stages of embryo formation. They're looking at how are those cells controlled and how a mutation in just one gene can have catastrophic consequences by affecting that tiny group of cells. They're using a powerful new technology called single-cell RNA sequences. And using that, they've been able to look deeply into the early processes of embryo genetics. Now, we can do genome sequencing and find genetic variants, but the challenge is figuring out which cell is the variant functioning in. In other words, which cell is it turned on in? Because all we're looking at is the encyclopedia. We don't know what's being read. And with birth defects, it's so time sensitive and so location sensitive that it's been extraordinarily difficult to study. Big data to the rescue. The researchers studied nearly 40,000, that's 40,000 individual cardiac cells from a mouse model of heart development. And they've been able to see all the different heart cells and all the different stages. It's taken basically 20 years for the technology and the tools to evolve to the point that we can look in on this. And of course, some of the research, they found a very complete picture of a particular gene called HAND2 and how it is responsible for the formation of the right ventricle. Sometimes the right ventricle doesn't form properly and the outflow tract doesn't develop. I'm not going to dive deeply into the genetics here because I think it's still not ready for prime time. But I want to share with you the study, the concept or the suggestion that you look at embryology and go look at some of the movies on YouTube that show the development of in these various stages. And it walks you through in beautiful kind of 3D cartoons. It's fantastic and beautiful, and it's inspiring to see how one cell transforms, and it really makes you value the genetic piece here. We're going to go to our first caller, and this is Eileen. Hello, Eileen. You're on the air.
Hello. Hey, I want to ask you, since people are talking and the politicians are talking about Medicare, this, that, and everything else, probably right now, I want to know how it is from your doctor point of view, because I had a real eye-opening, moment when one of the candidates said, hey, if you do Medicare for all, it's not adequately funded, and you're going to shut down a lot of rural facilities and clinics and hospitals. Is that correct?
Medicare for all? Would
in- well, any idea that you know, it, could there be consequences we're not noticing that he brings up?
Oh, God, yes. First of all, we're having a real problem keeping rural hospitals open. Because who lives there? You know, not people who work for Microsoft, right? Not people with good health and good corporate health insurance, self-employed people, entrepreneurs like myself. I mean,
me?
Yes. I will simply tell people that last year I and my husband were both in our 60s and we're both full-time employees of our own company, and we make enough not to qualify for any kind of subsidy. And by the way, the threshold for that is a household income of about $110,000 for two people, which is basically a living wage in Santa Cruz. Anyway, the point is, I paid $25,000 for my health insurance, and that was with a $6,000 deductible.
And you could look at the rest of us.
Precisely. I could.
Oh,
it's not like I could take a vacation. And yes, I could. But think about that. Think about that. That's 25% of my income. And yes, of course, I'm going to pay it. I'm not going to go bare. That would be foolish. But and I'm totally down with the fact that our piecemeal step towards some sort of more egalitarian system, I knew that was going to burn me. Because where are they going to get the money? And so, yeah, I know that. And I'm not playing the pity violin here. Don't get me wrong. What I'm saying is that if you're a farmer, you're there. Okay. If you're a farmer and you're making, then that's happening. If you're a small business person anywhere, if you're running the brew pub, down on, you know, Walnut Avenue, that person is in this same boat. So, it's a very inegalitarian system, but when you get out into the countryside where the rural hospitals are, there's only a few people with commercial insurance anyway. And everybody else is either Medi-Cal, Medicaid, or they're in my position. And if I got to go on Medicare, then the hospital would lose its last little trickle of profit margin. Do you understand that profit margin that keeps the hospital going is coming from those few people who still have commercial insurance, who still buy it? And that's the problem. So we can't just turn a switch. The comment about the rural hospitals is absolutely accurate. There's a whole bunch of other things that happen if the rural hospitals go belly up, among which is that lots of people die on the two-hour ambulance ride down the mountain or across the desert to get to the nearest emergency room, which is, you know, not a good result. But so that's, you know, I would say that we have to think very carefully about how we do this. And we didn't think terribly carefully in 2014 about what was going to happen to insurance rates. And it was obvious what would happen for anybody who was paying attention, but the politicians weren't focused on actual real-world results. They were focused on what they're focused on. I mean, you can see that. I don't need to list it for you. So I do worry. I worry about the laws being written by 25-year-old policy wonks with, you know, master's degrees who have always worked for the government or been a student and have no concept of what And don't get sick, so they don't really understand what it's like to be wrestling with our healthcare system. And
until it hits your family, then maybe that's a wake up call.
Maybe if they are engaged enough with their family, but a lot of these people are coming. A lot of these people went to Ivy League schools. That's why they're Washington a policy wonks, and you know, they probably come from a privileged background where this just isn't an issue for them. But in other words, I don't think that that many people have an actual perspective. And so that worries me. Medicare for All is a nice little bit, a nice little political slogan, but I don't know what it means.
That's what's scaring me is, as they pointed out in the debates last night, that the Republicans are just going to use this if you keep pushing that label.
Well,
and
you know,
I'm going, okay, then define your terms. What do you mean? And then everybody's getting all mushy and fuzzy about the details. They don't really know. And at some point, I keep thinking, are we trying to get to a point where no matter what doctor you go to, there's a fee structure in place and there's just a unified payer system?
Well, I think we should look at the German. I think we should look at this at the German system. Okay, I think the German system's excellent. Germany is, you know, it's not as big as the United States. It's a pretty big country. By the way, the German system was set up in about 1890 by Chancellor Bismarck, before, you know, well before World War One.
And an economist?
No, but he was a very, very smart politician, and he understood how to keep communism out of Germany. And that was largely what was going on. That was the subtext there, is the specter of communism. The workers needed health insurance, and they had, you know, they weren't, didn't have it. And so creating health insurance and a health insurance system made a lot of sense. People have to buy into the health insurance. There is a mandate. So they have to, they're required to have health insurance. The health insurance companies are all private. They compete with each other. But there is price regulation, and the government has a lot of rules about what you need to be able to do to participate in the health insurance.
Like public utility, in a sense.
Well, yeah, that's a really that's
okay,
the
now
that's the best metaphor.
And no, there's no legitimacy for raising the drug price up 500%, whatever.
Oh, well, that's
scandalous.
Yeah. Well, okay, but that was baked in. Bush 1. No, Bush 2. It was early Bush 2. And I remember it was signed into law at like 1 in the morning. It was like, oh, wait, we finally got enough Republic. We can finally vote this through. They just basically burnt. They said they were going to vote on it in the morning. And then the Democrats went home and then they voted and they got it through. And what it did was it specifically prohibited Medicare from doing any negotiation on prices. And then they put in the Medicare Part D thing. So that was
how lame can you get?
Oh no, that wasn't lame at all. It was diabolical. You just have to understand the motives. So
how do you sell that to your people when you go home as a congressperson?
Oh, you don't. You just distract them. You just
and they won't notice next time they go pay for their prescriptions. Okay, never mind.
Well, basically, the price of drugs is hidden from the doctors. It's hidden from the patients. Let me put in a pitch. First of all, you can always lie, but beyond that, let me put in a pitch for what the sane consumer does right now. Okay, this is what the sane consumer does. Your doctor writes you for a new prescription. Or an old prescription that gets rejected. This is happening all the time now. A person's been on this drug for, you know, 10 years, and suddenly they're wanting me to authorize it. And that always sends a flag up in my head, because it means that they're going to profiteer off of this. And so here's what you do. You go to www.goodrx, just good, the word good, rx.com. You put in the name of your drug. And you search it, and you try to search the dose and the amount that your prescription's written for. And what will come up is the estimated cash price, and then there'll be a coupon price. And essentially, GoodRx is a pro bono pharmacy benefit manager for the people. And what you can print out that coupon, it generally, a drug that might list at $150, you might pay $34. Your copay is now for drugs. A drug that costs $4, you may have a $20 copay for it. The pharmacists are actually forbidden by contract, and they get fired if they tell you that you should just pay the $5 rather than the $25 that your insurance wants to pay as a copay. They're profiteering off the copays, and they're skimming the copay by creating a high copay. There's no law against this. They can set the copay whatever they want. But you know what? The actual drug only costs $5 retail. So you want to go check the retail price. If the retail, and you want to get the coupon for your pharmacy, and it's by pharmacy, so you get the Walgreens or the Costco, warehouse pharmacy. Why are we not telling you which one? Okay. Warehouse pharmacy is always Costco, at least in this area. So you get the coupon. You go in. The doctor sent the prescription, and you show up at the front. They say, that'll be $35. And you say, oh, I'm so sorry. I forgot to tell you I wanted to use this coupon. And or you just buy it, you know, or it's, so you can legally ask what's the retail price for this. You can go online and figure out what the retail price for using this website or others. And you have to shop. You basically have to think like, I'm buying a used Chevy. So what are you going to do? You're going to go look at online cars. You're going to go look at the Blue Book. You're going to look at the reputation of the dealership you're buying it from. You're maybe going to take it over to the mechanic. And we all know to do that for used cars. But we have to start thinking like we're dealing with a used car salesman when we're dealing with the pharmaceutical industry, and not just blindly trusting that our insurance is going to take care of us, because our insurance companies have abandoned the very expensive burden of this prior authorization and the monitoring, and they've farmed it out to these pharmacy benefit managers who are profiteering shamelessly. And guess who's footing
another
the
middleman?
Just what we needed.
Yeah, of course.
You know, if you want to ask me what they should be talking about, well, they should be talking about that. And by the way, we are at California Medical Association. We are working with, thank God, we've got a governor this term that cares about healthcare and wants to be like the famous for his healthcare reforms. And, you know, we need to ride this pony as far as we can go, because if we can build it here, it can become the model for the nation. And that's really what we want. We don't want to let them build it in Washington. It's very simple. They are too obligated to public interests. It will be subverted. It will be distorted. I don't want them to build it. So in the short run, while we're building it in California, because we aren't going to get this thing built in a year or two, I'd like to be able to buy in to Medicare. I think the opt-in for people who, you know, either they're going semi-retired or they had a really good job in industry. And here in California, man, if you're 50, you're struggling to keep employed, because there's huge ageism in the big industries like Silicon Valley, hugely ageist, and they just want to kind of cut you loose and get some young guy. And there's no law against that. That type of discrimination is completely legal, and it's happening massively. And so you've got all of these people, you know, struggling to stay afloat, and they're 50, and maybe they even have a health problem besides being 50, which is enough to get you redlined by most into the highest category of risk by most insurance companies. And, you know, they're just guarding their corporate interest, and there's nothing to stop them because insurance isn't a utility. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to run an electrical line or a phone line out to the people in Aromas. You know, there aren't enough of them. It doesn't. And there's a lot of maintenance. You know, they got trees coming down all the time and taking out the electricity, and they're sending all these electricians out to fix that. I mean, if you were not a utility, you'd say, you know, we just can't afford to keep maintaining Aromas. We'll just cut them off, and they can go, you know, they can go off the grid, and, you know, lucky them. And this is, you know, this is the fast internet. You know, I happen to live in an area with snail internet, so I can say that since the internet's not a utility and it's not treated as a utility, we don't have it where I live. We do have electricity and landlines, however, because those are utilities. So yes, health insurance needs to be treated as a utility. There need to be serious laws to prevent profiteering by pharmaceutical companies, and serious teeth when they cheat, because we got to send some people to jail. If these guys know that they would actually do time, it's a completely different thing. than if they think that they're just going to have to pay a couple million-dollar fine.
Oh, yet those fines probably just come out of the stockholders' end. You know?
Well, that's just it. It's no skin off their. It's really not a problem for them if they know they're going to do time. And I mean, I'm talking about, you know, the people at Purdue and the crap that they pulled with the MS Cotton. You got to do time for that, okay? I mean, the guy who's dealing marijuana up until very recently, he was going to go to jail, and these folks, you know, didn't. I'm sorry. We got to take a whole look at the white collar crime issue. Another conversation. So, yeah, they're talking. Well, and what other follow up questions do you have? And
well, just one other thing was, you know, I'm 68, so Medicare kicked in for me, thank God, a few years ago. But are there doctors who just won't do it because the reimbursement is just not adequate?
Well, a lot of doctors have just, and this started about 10 years ago, just closed to new Medicare. Because for those of us who were educated more than 10 years ago, it feels highly unethical to kick someone out of your practice because they go to Medicare. I mean, remember that relationship thing I was talking about at the top of the hour? That cuts both ways. I have an obligation to my patients, and that obligation includes continuing to keep them as patients. If I own my business or control my decisions, which isn't true for people working for large multi-specialty groups. So, you know, that aside, those large multi-specialty groups work really hard to keep that invisible to the doctors so that the doctors don't realize that they're violating their code of ethics, which they are a lot of times, but since it's unconscious, you don't get the pang. But anyway, you just don't take new people. So you have all your old people. They age out. You continue to see them. You stop making money off of them, but that's okay. You take on more patients and you manage to keep the place afloat until the electronic medical record came on in and we had the additional overhead or 3 or 4 hours a day of paperwork or electronic work, data entry that only the doctor could do, which was not how it worked on paper. But once we went electronic, it did. So that was just that was bad.
I was wondering I was driving here. I was wondering, what is it she's mad about with the electronic stuff? Because it seems like it could be a real lifesaver if somebody can access really relevant information.
Yeah, if it didn't
in the ER or something.
If I could delegate the data entry, it would be fine. But they still suck because they don't talk to each other, and you're sitting there trying to get on to some double, triple authentication thing in order to look up your patient's lab tests, which takes, you know, 10 minutes that I could be spending with the patient building rapport. And instead, I'm staring at a screen. Plus, the patient's getting angry at me because I'm staring at a screen, which I don't blame them. But on the other hand, I'm actually staring at the screen on their behalf. But I should be able to let my employee, you know, get that record should be available instantaneously. The technology is there. If it was their bank account, we could get to it a lot more easily than their medical record. Anyway.
Oh, can you still nanosecond? You bet.
Yeah. So, and how long does it take to find a product on Google when you want to buy something? So, you know we can do this really fast, but they've made it really slow. And that has to change if we're going to, that's part of the politics. Anyway.
When it came to the ACA rollout, why didn't they hire the Amazon people? Because, man, they're pretty damn fast. You know, no matter what they tackle, they're
follow the money, my friend. Follow the money. Listen, we're going to sign off now, but thank you for an interesting call and keep listening.
You bet. Will do.
Bye-bye. Let's talk breasts, huh? That should wake you up. So breast milk specifically is a very, very important, perfect food for children. And a lot of women stop breastfeeding because they don't feel that they're producing enough milk. They think they're not giving their baby what they need. Initially, the first couple, 3 days that you're breastfeeding, you don't get a lot of milk. You get a lot of colostrum, which is full of antibodies and full of probiotics. So very, very good for the kid. And yet, you know, the baby is, you know, sucking hard on the breast. And of course, the woman's not used to breastfeeding if she's a novice. So many women give up or start supplementing. And, you know, we want to support them to, you know, give it a little bit more time. Let's just watch the baby. They won't lose weight. And I always remind my new mothers about, you know, it, and you hear it every time there's a terrible earthquake somewhere and a building falls down and they're digging through the rubble and they've been digging through the rubble for days. And you get out to about 1 week and everybody's like given up, and then they hear this thin little cry and they'll, you know, frantically dig. And it's always like the youngest baby imaginable, like the week old infant is the one that survives the 1 week of dehydration. And there's a reason for that. We are essentially adapted to be born to naive mothers who don't quite know what they're doing and who don't get it right away. And amazingly enough, we also have all these adaptations to handle things like dehydration. Go out a month and the child is totally vulnerable to dehydration. But that first couple of magic weeks, they can, you know, survive amazingly well. Okay, getting back to the story. This is a study that was done by the World Health Organization, or at least they provided some funding. It was done by Mahidol University in Thailand. And they wanted to look at traditional herbs that are supposed to help with breast milk. So they studied fenugreek, ginger, and turmeric. 50 breastfeeding women, age 20 to 40, 1 month postpartum, exclusively breastfeeding. So they were randomly assigned to an herbal formula. It had, and I'm going to give you the doses, 200 milligrams of fenugreek seed, 120 milligrams of ginger, and 100 milligrams of turmeric per capsule. And they were supposed to take 3 capsules 3 times a day. So they did milk volume tests, and the breastfeeding mothers getting the herbal supplements had about a 50% increase at week 2 and a 100% doubling of their milk supply at week 4, whereas in the placebo group, things went up. They went up 11% at week 2 and 24% at week 4. So I will say my niece is expecting, and so this jumped out at me because, you know, I thought, I know she wants to breastfeed, and I thought that this was a good supplement to go see if I could find and send her as a gift. The major components in fenugreek we know, it's terpenoids and something called diosgenin. And these are compounds that have been shown in scientific studies to stimulate the anterior pituitary gland to release more prolactin. And I want to put out, breastfeeding while stressed is difficult, because adrenaline and stress inhibit the release of oxytocin. And so you don't get the opening up of the glands, the so-called letdown, that allows for the milk to flow. So it's good to be in a quiet, relaxed environment and not in a hurry. And this is one of those situations where working from home is probably very good. Let the phone ring. Turn off the, don't look at the phone. Put on some nice music. Watch a relaxation video. Hold your baby. Tickle their toes, and just get into a relaxed state. This is a wonderful moment, and that will do more probably than even the supplements in improving your milk production, but certainly your milk release. The fenugreek takes only about 72 hours to work. No one's quite sure how the ginger works, but they're thinking maybe it increases blood circulation. And turmeric, of course, is an anti-inflammatory, so it reduces pain and inflammation in the breast, and that may be how it works. No one's done the anterior pituitary studies with these other two agents, but the combination was extraordinarily successful, and I found the study quite impressive. So I'm marking it with a big open square, which is what I do when I have to go do something with one of these articles, or I want to more carefully incorporate it into my handouts or my medical practice. So this one's a serious keeper. So we've only got about 5 minutes. I'm going to close the phones at this point. as I don't think I can do justice to a call, and move to my little quickies and give you some more health news. So there's been an increase in the number of young children swallowing small objects, particularly batteries, over the last 2 decades. And of course, more objects in our homes are powered by small batteries. And it's one of those things where there were kids getting electrocuted because they found a bobby pin and stuck it into the electric outlet. And it became a thing in our culture to have, if you've got a crawler, that you get yourself some outlet covers that are more or less crawler proof in order to prevent that from happening. So this was a study done in Columbus, Ohio. And in 1995, there were 2,200 kids in the year brought in Columbus for having swallowed batteries. In 2015, it was up to 43,000, more than doubling. The button batteries are a problem. So I am urging you, when you take out a button battery, have some tape, like Scotch tape, in your hand, and immediately take the tape, put it on the button battery, and attach that to a wall, a object that is above the level the kid can get to. Just tape it to the backsplash on the, you know, next to the sink where you dry the dishes. It doesn't matter where you put it. Just get it off the floor, get it off of where it can get knocked down when you grab up some papers. And that's what the tape is for. It keeps it from moving. It keeps it where it is. Battery ingestions. Now, this is the hospitalizations for swallowing coins, batteries, and small objects. Battery ingestions went up 150-fold. And that's because of all these batteries around. And this can cause a fatal internal burn. This can actually kill a kid. And, you know, because it's salty down there in the gut, and it causes electricity to flow. And this can be extraordinarily dangerous. And it requires sometimes open surgery to get the thing out. So let's be safe. Let's protect our children. It's so important. And this goes for grandchildren, aunties, uncles, anybody who might have a crawler in the house. You need to crawl around yourself if your knees will take it, and do your due diligence and keep that place safe. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.